Dr. Jenny Cook is a highly skilled gynecologist, fertility specialist, and advanced laparoscopic surgeon. With over 20 years experience in gynecology and fertility, Jenny's special interests are fertility treatment, endometriosis, fibroids, and hysteroscopic surgery. She has published widely in the area of gynecologic laparoscopy and has also presented at many national and international meetings. She has trained at overseas units and has attained the highest level of advanced laparoscopic surgery. Jenny wholly understands the stresses which single women face and is well regarded to discuss the role for egg freezing and donor sperm, which allows same-sex couples and single women to fulfill their dreams of creating a family. A highly regarded expert in her field, Jenny consults from Monash IVF Bondi Junction, where she has recently been appointed the clinical director. Jenny, welcome to the Female Athlete Project.
Thank you so much for having me here, Chloe. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm really looking forward to having a chat, and I am a Monash IVF ambassador myself, and I'm really passionate about empowering women through education. And as we mentioned in the introduction, you've got a very extensive career in this area, so I'm really looking forward to having a chat to you about fertility, women's health, how that intersects with sport, and we've also had a number of people submit some questions anonymously too. To kick us off, can we start talking about periods and what is normal for a woman to experience? What's painful that should be accepted and painful where you should start to seek some more medical advice?
That's a very good question. So the normal range for a period is 28 to 35 days. I suppose most women will have a monthly cycle. So to start off with, if there is any degree of irregularity, that's not normal, and that's something that can be investigated and treated if necessary. Pain. If the pain feels wrong and there's too much pain, then it needs to be investigated. I see too many women who say, I just thought this was normal. You know, all women experience pain, and you're nodding in an understanding way. Any degree of pain which doesn't feel right is not right and needs to be investigated. And of course, a primary cause would be endometriosis, and there's something that we can do about it. I always say to women, you don't need to suffer with it. There's something that we can do about it.
Yeah, it's a really big topic, endometriosis, and something that a lot of female athletes may have been diagnosed, may suspect that there's something else going on with the level of pain that they're experiencing with their periods. What are some of the common management strategies used for painful periods and potentially endometriosis?
So the gold standard for the treatment of endometriosis is to do what's called a laparoscopy and to remove all visible disease, and then to do something to stop, to minimise the risk that endometriosis will reproliferate. And the most common modality there would be something called the Mirena. It's a device you can put inside the uterus which releases progesterone. Another alternative would be the oral contraceptive pill. But I fully recognise that female elite athletes are tied down to a competing schedule and a tight training schedule, and they can't always take time out to have a laparoscopy. So short of that, and this is not the gold standard, but I think in the interests of managing the symptoms in the meantime, the oral contraceptive pill would be an ideal way to result in a regular cycle and to make periods lighter and less painful, and possibly to minimize the risk that endometriosis will continue to proliferate. The other modality would be to just put in what, as I referred to before, the Mirena. But I would stress that it's a temporary procedure. If you have significant endometriosis, that may help with the pain, but it's certainly not a cure or a treatment that I would advocate in the long term.
Yeah, and even in my personal experience, I've been on the contraceptive pill to help try and manage some of that pain, and then yeah. I've had periods of time coming off the pill, and it's almost sometimes working out. Is this something that I want to do if it's not the best option in a way?
And clearly you would have come into the category of having a very tight schedule and just can't drop everything to commit to a laparoscopy and the recovery time involved. This is a conversation that I often have with women, and sometimes there's no perfect solution. It's sometimes a matter of looking at how do you feel on the pill and how do you feel off the pill? What side effects are you experiencing on the pill? How well is it controlling your pain? And it may be necessary to take additional analgesia such as Panadol or some form of a non-steroidal. Sorry, when you're off the pill, how do you feel off the pill? And how is the pain going? The pill is a very safe and effective modality, and I would say to you, if it's making your life easier, you go with the pill.
Mm. Putting the pill to the side for a second,
yep.
Is it normal for female athletes to miss their period?
So we're now talking about women who aren't on the pill. Yes, it is very common. So the medical term for that, it's a long word. It's called hypothalamic amenorrhea. But in simple terms, what that means is whenever you put your body under stress, physical or emotional stress, your ovaries can shut down. So they don't release an egg every month. And that's more likely to happen to elite athletes who are doing a lot of high intensity exercise and who probably have a lower body mass index. One figure that I've come across is that in 65, it's ovulatory disorders are seen in up to 65% of long distance runners.
Wow.
Compared to about 5% of the population.
It's quite a significant number.
Yeah.
And is it something, do you think that, and you probably can't comment on behalf of athletes, but is it something, do you think, sometimes that athletes might normalize it? I'm just having a really heavy training block.
I'm sure that's the case. We became aware of a swimmer who contacted our inquiry line after the alliance, the partnership was announced with Monash IVF, who basically indicated now she understands why she wasn't getting periods, and it was the high level of intense exercise. She normalized it, and there absolutely was a reason for it. Look, the thing that I might go on to say is if you're not getting periods, clearly that's going to have a knock-on effect for fertility. But the second thing will be if you've got low estrogen, that's going to have a knock-on effect for bone density in the long term. And the risk of osteopenia, thinning of the bones leading on to osteoporosis, is something you need to think about. That would be another reason to have some form of estrogen replacement, just low dose in the form of the oral contraceptive pill and vitamin D.
Looking at fertility and athletes, we're starting to see a number of athletes progress further into their career with different advancements in science and technology, and probably challenging stereotypes in a way around how long women can be playing professional sport. We're seeing the emergence of a number of professional leagues domestically and expansion of global leagues. How do you see it looking for women playing sport for longer, having to factor in the fertility conversation?
Look, the fertility conversation needs to be a conversation that is had. That's really all I can say there. It's absolutely wonderful that women are now in a position to play their sport longer, their chosen career, if you like, because of, you know, recognition of pay and everything. But there needs to be support around that. I feel this alliance with Monash is a step in the right direction, but the sporting codes need to step up as well. There needs to be discussion around the recognition that some women are going to have problems falling pregnant, particularly athletes who may be away from home at a time that they're ovulating, who may be overseas for long periods of time, who may have physical consequences of their sport leading to ovulatory problems where they're going to have difficulty conceiving, quite apart from the other factors that women experience, such as endometriosis. Athletes will experience all of that as well. There just needs to be more recognition around that.
When we post content on our social channels on the Female Athlete Project around female athletes and fertility, there's often a couple of people in the comment sections who are just like, well, you can just freeze your eggs, almost as if it's this real guarantee that the second you retire from sport, you can just get pregnant using your frozen eggs. Can you touch on?
Absolutely. I'm a big advocate of egg freezing. The technology of surrounding egg freezing has improved dramatically in the last 10 years, and it really is a viable option for young women to preserve fertility. But I have to say, it's a good insurance policy, but it's not a guarantee of pregnancy. And for a woman in her 30s, if I did one egg collection, roughly the statistics would be about a 30% chance of a pregnancy afterwards. And that's without me knowing anything about her blood results and her ovarian reserve. So I'd normally say have it in your mind that you'll have it 2 egg collections.
Mm-hmm. And do you think there's certain conversations that can be had? You've touched on a couple of times that partnership between Monash IVF and the Australian Athletes Alliance, which I think is so important for the education piece. That egg freezing piece is obviously a big part of that as well, right?
No, definitely. Because, look, egg freezing and embryo freezing, if women are in a situation to do that, that's really what we've got. If a woman makes the decision to put off fertility, have some sort of an insurance policy, and that's the best one that we've got.
I'd love to jump into some of the anonymous questions that have been submitted. I love you've got some notes prepared. I'm looking forward to these. So how can female athletes use knowledge of their cycle to improve their performance?
So there's such a lack of research regarding female elite athletes and fertility, their cycle, pregnancy, and the postpartum period. But to focus on their cycle, there was some work done by the doctor of the Women's Cricket Association getting women to chart their cycle. And I now believe that other sporting codes are doing that, and in terms of measuring their performance, but I haven't seen any results. So I can't answer this question using scientific knowledge, but if I looked at it logically, my answer would be, what are the negative factors of a cycle and how that may detract from performance, and how can we overcome that? And the first one that comes to mind is PMS, premenstrual symptoms, which are unfortunately very common. Women can experience bloating, breast tenderness, depression, lack of drive in the days before their menstrual cycle starts. I believe that PMS is poorly understood and poorly treated, but various modalities to address it would be, to look at your diet to avoid caffeine and chocolate, because that's known to exacerbate it. Maybe this is something that the female elite athletes are already avoiding. To try and plan their day to avoid stressful decisions, well, that's going to be difficult because they're already committed to a tight schedule. Probably the oral contraceptive pill again, and the mechanism of action is just thought to be it dampens down all their hormones, and they're not exposed to the ups and downs of the hormones so much. The second negative impact of a menstrual cycle on performance is going to be if you've got severe period pain. If it's endometriosis, have it assessed, by a gynecologist who knows about it. A detailed history, a detailed imaging, if necessary, discussion on a laparoscopy. And with hormonal manipulation afterwards to minimize the risk of it coming back, so a Mirena or the oral contraceptive pill. And I think that the very sad thing here is that it is acceptable to say, I've got an ACL injury, or I've got some other physical injury, I can't perform. But if you say, I've got severe period pain and that's going to affect my performance, there would be a lot of concern about how that the response to that would be. And it shouldn't be like that. Female elite athletes are going to have that problem and should be in a position where they can talk to someone about it in an open forum and feel comfortable.
Yeah, and unfortunately that's something I've experienced personally myself, that feeling of not feeling like I would be validated and heard and understood. And a lot of the time in a sporting environment, because there's not great pathways yet around coaching and strength and conditioning, a lot of the time that conversation is being had with a male staff member that can put further barriers in place for a female athlete to feel comfortable to have those conversations. Yeah. And something I've touched on in the past is my club at GWS are now making sure that all the male staff participate in our education sessions around women's health and fertility. Double thumbs up.
Big double thumbs up.
Love that. I love that. On to the next question. This is an interesting one. Not to sound like this question is from the 1800s, but is there any heightened risk to our reproductive organs when playing contact sports, which involve tackles or kicks to the stomach?
Yeah. So firstly, every question is valid. And this question is not from the 1800s. Clearly, I understand if you were playing a contact sport, it'd be something you'd worry about. Am I doing damage? I cannot think of any conceivable way that you could damage the uterus, tubes, or ovaries by repeated tackles or kicks to the stomach. I mean, you could damage other organs which are very close to the surface, but not the uterus, tubes, and ovaries.
As someone with endometriosis, is there anything I can do to minimize the effects of endo on my exercise or sport experiences?
Yeah, my answer to that is going to be to address the pain. And I may be repeating an answer that I've given earlier. There are non-invasive modalities to address the pain, and that would be taking the oral contraceptive pill on a continuous basis or the Mirena intrauterine device, which releases progesterone. But I have to stress the gold standard for managing endometriosis is to do a laparoscopy and definitively remove all visible disease, and then a second modality to minimize the risk of it coming back, either the Mirena or the oral contraceptive pill.
Are steps being taken to address medical misogyny?
I'm uncertain about what medical misogyny means, and I can only imagine it was older gynecologists in years gone by saying, there you go, lovey-deary, period pain's normal, you just put up with it, have a baby and it'll go away. And that is not our current thinking, not at all. We have definitely grown in our understanding of what causes period pain. There is so much research going into it, and I can say personally, I've done laparoscopy now for 25 years, and I have learned over that time that we need to become even more aggressive in our management of endometriosis. There would be too many times where a woman says, I've got pain on the left side, and when you look laparoscopically, it looks normal, but you remove the area, it treats her pain and it comes back as endometriosis. And, you know, when I was doing my training, I would have been taught to leave that. But that's how my approach to endometriosis has changed over 25 years. And I would say as a group of gynecologists, we are growing in our understanding of endometriosis and how it's treated. And even so much research going into it, looking at other medical modalities to treat it, something called estrogen receptor modulators, which opens up a whole new area. But the future is looking bright. We haven't got there yet. We've still got a long way to go.
It's really interesting just hearing you touch on that idea around how you've developed over that time. And even for me going through this process, I haven't been diagnosed with endometriosis, but I experienced significant pain and I've had internal ultrasounds done. And it's a horrible feeling to walk away and someone saying, we can't see anything.
So this is a story I hear every day of my life.
Yeah.
The vast majority of women I see with endometriosis have a completely normal ultrasound.
Wow.
And that doesn't mean that they haven't got it. That just means that the non-invasive imaging techniques that we've got, which are limited, won't pick it up.
Mm.
Look, we know that a laparoscopy with definitive treatment of endometriosis and a hysteroscopy, which means looking inside the uterus, will have a positive impact on natural fertility. We've never shown that it improves the success of IVF. That doesn't mean that it doesn't. but we've never shown that it does. And there's also no internationally accepted indications for doing a laparoscopy before you do fertility treatment. But my own personal feeling would be, if you've got a cyst on your ovaries due to endometriosis, I would do a laparoscopy and fix that up. And I stress paying particular attention to preserving normal ovarian tissue, because that is critical for fertility, clearly. That will improve my ability to stimulate the ovaries and minimize the risk of infection. Two, if a woman has significant pain, there is the risk that IVF will exacerbate that and make it worse. So that would be a discussion that I would have before. Three would be a woman who doesn't want to take hormones and is in a situation where she could conceive naturally. So we would talk about the role for a laparoscopy. And four would be, if you, whatever you do doesn't work, you have to come back to what I call the drawing board and perhaps consider a new direction. If you've done two cycles of IVF and it hasn't worked, you need to talk about a laparoscopy. You don't have endless cycles before you think, what else could I have done?
And I think you've actually answered a question that had been submitted. I think it was this one, and I've recently been diagnosed with deeply invasive endometriosis, DIE. We are wanting to start a family as a same-sex couple with me going through the IVF process. My doctor has said we should try IVF prior to surgery, but also said we could look at surgery to try and remove the endo. Is there any evidence of going straight to IVF over surgery for endo, or is the surgery likely to help the IVF process? But surgery pre-IVF also means a longer wait to start the IVF process. So you've kind of already answered that one, haven't you, there?
Yeah. No, there's no scientific evidence. That may be a limitation of the research that's being done. It doesn't mean that it doesn't improve the success, but we don't have that scientific evidence.
This person has asked, how can we promote fertility education to women earlier? As an educator, I see my students exposed to safe sex practices to avoid pregnancy, but no current opportunity to empower young women with knowledge that may support proactive decisions in regard to having or planning to have children.
And clearly, teenagers and women in their 20s, we talk about contraception, and suddenly they get into their 30s and we say, you got to get pregnant now. Did we not tell you that before? It can only be with programs in schools. And there are, with all this research that's being done, there's a lot of research that's being done in period problems in teenagers, and that is going out into the schools. And I can tell you, with my personal involvement with a school nearby, they are learning about endometriosis, and you know, that is one thing that I thought, well, I could contribute to that conversation further. It's education in schools, and bringing up the discussion on fertility, that it doesn't last forever. I think the second way is really what we're achieving through the Australian Athletes Alliance and Monash IVF, to educate and empower women to help them better understand their reproductive health, why they might be experiencing menstrual irregularities or period pain, and what can be done about it, and empowering them to make decisions to help them achieve a baby now or in the future if they want to, really to in align with what their plans might be.
This person has asked, I'm 33 and made the decision to freeze my eggs 2 years ago after receiving a low AMH of 12. If women want children, how much should we respond to our AMH scores? I know people who have actively started trying to have children because they had a low score and were told they would struggle to get pregnant. Then many of them have had little trouble getting pregnant. While I acknowledge that there are individual factors that impact conception, I've seen this score put a lot of pressure and stress on my friends. It doesn't seem to be the most reliable measure to help us plan for our future.
So firstly, you can plot AMH, anti-Müllerian hormone, out against age, and 12 at the age of 33 would actually come within the normal range. I even think off the top of my head, it might even be around the 50th percentile. AMH is not the new black of fertility investigations. It's not a standalone investigation. It's important. It tells me how your ovarian reserve or the number of eggs you have left plots out against a group of women who are a similar age. So it tells me if you've got expected ovarian reserve or low, but it's just part of the story. It is part of the picture that we paint when we do all the investigations to work out a woman's individual fertility. Another important measure of ovarian reserve would be an ultrasound to look at the ovaries, to look at the number of what we call follicles. The eggs sit inside follicles, and the actual follicle count is also a critical measure of ovarian reserve. But having said all of that, a woman's fertility is linked most closely to her age, which means a woman in her 20s may have low ovarian reserve. She may have a low AMH or antral follicle count, but she will still get pregnant because she's young and she has good ovarian reserve. A woman in her late 30s or early 40s will have lower egg quality, and the additional impact of low ovarian reserve is going to create a problem, and she will struggle to get pregnant.
As a single queer female in her late 20s who's been researching about having a baby on her own, I've seen so much about what types of procedures there are, but never enough about how to start the whole process, even down to what I should be looking for in clinics or red flags. Is there some advice you could offer on this? The internet is still just full of articles of couples with only a small part for single women or anyone who doesn't fit a standard nuclear family ideal.
So that is a wonderful question. I would say the first thing that you need to consider is the specialist you're going to see. You need to know that you can have a rapport with that person because it might be a short journey or it might go on for a long time. You need to know that you've got trust and understanding there.
I think we've covered all of the questions that have been submitted.
I'm just interested. It seems to me that the next step forward for women is to have the sporting codes on board. And from my reading, the Cricket Australia is leading the way there, but I'm just wondering about the other sporting codes and where they are with that, because it really does seem to be the next step. Women are going to be playing sport at the elite level for longer, and we need to support them with that, both during a pregnancy, maternity agreements, breastfeeding afterwards, taking the young child, support to take the young child when they're touring and competing away from their home. I'm now asking you a question.
The tables
have
turned.
That just seemed to be the next obvious step.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting progression seeing the way that the collective bargaining agreements between players' associations and the sporting bodies have developed over time. And as you touched on, Cricket Australia has really led the way in that space with their pregnancy and parental policies. And sporting bodies like the AFL with the AFLW have now started to follow suit. So we recently signed off on a new collective bargaining agreement, and part of our pregnancy policy allows players to have security over their playing contract if they were to fall pregnant, which is such an important step. And there's also other provisions which the cricketers have as well around having a carer that can travel with you to games up to a certain age. I think each of the sporting bodies have different agreements in place, but really practical things that haven't been in place for a very long time. And I think they've started to really get the ball rolling. I think, as you've touched on, these conversations around fertility and age, egg freezing, women's health, there's so much more that can be addressed. And I think that's why this partnership between Monash IVF and the AAA is such an important one.
Fantastic. It's just wonderful to know that good work is being done and we're working towards the same goal.
Absolutely.
And we'll get there.
We will get there. Thank you so much for your time.
My absolute pleasure. It's been wonderful. Thank you, Chloe.
I've loved having you on. Thanks, Jenny. Thanks so much for listening. If you got something out of this episode, I would absolutely love it if you could send it on to one person who you think might enjoy it. Otherwise, subscribe, give us a review, and make sure you follow us on Instagram at The Female Athlete Project to stay up to date with podcast episodes, merch drops, and of course, news and stories about epic female athletes.